Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 18 years of law enforcement analysis experience and 21 years of law enforcement experience overall. She's a great instructor, presenter, and mentor, and she's a former IACA secretary and former president of MARCAN, Mid-America Regional Crime Analysis Network. She is a police officer turned analyst turned law enforcement liaison with Geotime. Please welcome Dawn Clausius. Dawn, how are we doing?
I'm doing great, Jason. How are you?
I am going very well. Thank you for joining me today.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity. This has been really cool to listen to and hear all of the people I both have known in the past and the new people I'll get to meet and hear all their stories. So I'm glad to be a part of this journey.
All right. Very good. Thank you. So let's get started. My first question is always the same. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Yeah. So my story is probably fairly normal for the time that I came into law enforcement through in terms of how people became crime analysts. And I actually became a police officer back in 1998. I graduated the police academy. And the reason I became an officer is because I saw Silence of the Lambs and I actually wanted to be an FBI agent. I was going to be the next Clarice Starling. Nice. And I truly believed like they were just going to hire me straight out of the academy and I was going to go directly on to solve a serial killer murder case. So I quickly learned that really doesn't happen in real life. And in order to even become an FBI agent at that time, I actually had to go get law enforcement experience. Those requirements have changed since, 2000. But I ended up becoming a police officer. I really loved it. I got assigned to crime prevention and became a crime prevention officer about 2 years into policing. So if you know anything, you know that I was still super green. I was still learning. But crime prevention offered me the opportunity to work with the community, which I really loved. It got me into the realm of, public speaking and education and really kind of doing different things that being an officer on the street in the community I was in, just we really didn't do unless you were in crime prevention. So while I was in crime prevention, the police department decided that they needed to become a CALEA accredited. For CALEA, there's a lot of different standards. So one of those standards happened to be crime analysis. So I had a sergeant at the time, which I will keep this vague, but he was a challenge. And he literally walked into my office and said, "Hey, we're trying to do this crime analysis thing and your title has crime in it and this has crime in it. So we feel like you should do this."
That's great.
So at the time I thought he was a moron. However, after kind of getting into it, he wasn't really far off. In fact, he was kind of spot on. So I got assigned this standard. I read through it. It was very vague at the time. And I tried to figure out how do I even start this crime analysis thing? Because like many analysts that fall into this, they get zero direction. They're told to do it. They even get hired to do it. And there's just, very little oversight or potentially any direction for them. And there's also no one like them at their agency. So what I did is I looked outside my agency and I was in the Kansas City metro area. And so I looked at Kansas City, Missouri. I contacted the analysts over there. They've had a unit for many, many years. And remember, this is back in 2000. Mm-hmm. I looked around Overland Park Police Department. Jerry Tallman over there was running a crime analysis unit. And his analysts were Jamie May. And his other analyst at the time was Susan Wernicke. So I reached out to them and I was like, "Hey, my name's Dawn. I'm an officer. And here's what I've been asked to do. Can I come sit with you?" And they were very, very open to that. Jerry Tallman was just a great educator and a really big IACA member as well as the other analysts over there. So I learned a lot from them. There's also a local analyst here that I don't know if it's appropriate to call her the godmother of crime analysis in our county, but she was. And she was really, and I don't know her actual title, but I would probably deem her being the investigations administrative assistant at the time. But she had really started embedding herself into a lot of the investigations for the county sheriff's office. She was open. So, you know, I'd go visit her. And if I had any questions, I'd reach out to her. So, you know, long story short, I started doing that in addition to my crime prevention. So
what was the name of the godmother?
Oh, I'm sorry. Beverly Redding. Okay. Beverly Redding. So if you're local, you know Bev. Bev has okay. since retired. But I mean, she was well known. She was super open. She would train you, ask, answer any questions and assist you in any way. So there was really this network of people, not a lot of them at the time, but mm-hmm. that, you know, I was able to reach out to. I also reached out to detectives that also were assigned to do this duty. They really didn't know that it was crime analysis, but that's what they were doing. And so I established myself at my small agency, which was Prairie Village, Kansas Police Department, as a officer slash analyst. And I started doing crime analysis. And I brought back little ideas and things that I could put into place at my small agency of about 44 sworn officers. Mm-hmm. Geographically, we were on the boundary of Kansas City, Missouri. So crime does not know that when you're going north, you're in Kansas City. And when you're going south, you're in the Kansas side. Mm-hmm. So, you know, crime travels, crime moves. So it really allowed us as a small agency to have that one person that people reached out to. And so that started my journey. Eventually, they're like, hey, we don't need you to do this anymore. And eventually I went back to the street. And when I was back on the street, I loved being a police officer. I was an emergency vehicle operations instructor for the state of Kansas and for our local police department. I became a sexual assault investigator. So I did do a lot of really cool things. I was on our rapid response team. And if you recall, that was like the time of Columbine. So we were doing a lot of training in that area. And so I was able to do a lot of different things, but there was always something missing. And I think what was missing for me is just really being able to use my education, my intuition, critical thinking skills in a different way in policing. So in around like 2006 or seven, I lose track of time, I had the opportunity to put in for a crime analyst position at the Olathe, Kansas Police Department. And although they had the position on the books, the person in it really wasn't doing what we would deem in the IACA as actually textbook crime analysis. The chief they had at the time wanted to change that up. She came from a different department. She was trying to change things and she always had an analyst. So I was able to get that position. And once I got that position, it just kind of took off from there.
A couple of things I'm thinking about as you're telling this part of your story, the crime prevention piece, before you were doing analysis, was it projects that you worked on? Was it the similar process of like, okay, we're looking at the data. We found that this seems to be a problem. We need to educate the public and we create a project. Was it similar before you started crime analysis as opposed to after?
So the crime prevention piece of it, our community was small and customer service, that's what I like to call it. Customer service was a very high level of customer service for our police department. And that was a result of very low crime. So violent crime was pretty low, but property crime was pretty high. I say high, higher, the higher of the crime types. And so what we did is we tried to obviously do the prevention. We tried to prevent residential burglaries through education, through outreach. We tried to prevent the theft from autos or auto break-ins or auto burglaries, however you deem it, by educating, you know, if we would read every police report every morning, that's what I would do. I would read every call for service and I would try to figure out, do we have a pattern? Do we have a crime? Do we have a series? At that time, I didn't know what those things were called. I just knew I'd read every police report and it looks like this neighborhood's getting hit. Mm-hmm. And then if I could narrow down why, and then I could figure out how to let our officers know. And then also how to go out to the community and let them know to, you know, do some prevention practices. And then also personally reach out to the victims, do residential surveys. I went to crime prevention school where you learned all about techniques, lock your doors. Sounds crazy, but a lot of people, you know, they really think that, you know, they should be able to keep their doors unlocked and they shouldn't be victimized. And I agreed with them, but when we identify a problem, there are some solutions to help mitigate that. So it was really a personal type service that I did for the community.
Sure. You mentioned that they told you don't need to do this anymore and sent you back on the street. So did they just get rid of crime prevention and analysis, or did they outsource that?
Yeah. So we were such a small agency that every position, regardless of what it was, rotated every 4 years.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't like I didn't do well or whatever. It was just, hey, we're very small. We want to create well-rounded officers. So we need everyone to have an opportunity. And that was their way. And that was whether you were in narcotics or you were in investigations or you were in any assignment, really, because they would just, you know, every 4 years it would rotate. You know, there's positives and negatives to that. But crime prevention, I think that was one of the things that it was a positive because it did allow everyone to kind of get out in the community and do different things. And they've had crime prevention since I left the agency. And I think now, which is interesting, there's kind of been a cycle where a lot of places got rid of it. And now you're seeing it come back due to all the things happening socially.
Mm-hmm. So was it tough going from Dawn, the police officer, to Dawn, the civilian analyst?
So that's a really interesting question. I think yes and no. So all the good stuff wasn't tough. So, you know, being on a normal schedule, being inside and not having to deal with the elements, you know, just some of those positives that come with not being on rotations. And from a personal standpoint, my husband was also a police officer at that time and still is. And he was rotating. I was rotating. We had a young child. We were literally passing our child off in the middle of the night. And so there, you know, the change was really welcomed. And I think timing is everything. But I would be totally, you know, lying if I told you that while I sat at my desk and my whole team gears up for something that's exciting for police officer Dawn and I don't get to participate. Yeah, man, I missed that. That's the fun stuff. I missed the fun stuff. But I think over the years, your role in the fun stuff, specifically as an analyst, just changes, you know? Mm-hmm. So for me, the fun stuff then turned into, you know, finding the needle in the needle stack, you know, doing the impossible. So it just changed.
So then you go to Olathe and there's not a unit established. So there's really no vision. You are just told to go. Which always to me is both good and bad that you can create it from the ground up, but at the same time, it's always good to have a reference point or a set of expectations.
I completely agree. And that was my experience. When I got hired, I remember being told during my hiring process at some point that like, all we know that you need to do are the stats, the administrative stats that are required by the state and required by, you know, FBI and all of that type of stuff. And the rest is up to you. I'm not a creative person in the sense of creativity from like coloring, drawing, or, you know, doing calligraphy or painting or things like that, art type stuff. But I am having the creativity to build something that I'm passionate about. I was like, this is awesome. Like, I can build this the way I see it. I can do what I think, you know, I would want to see when I was a police officer, what would be useful to me. In the beginning, it was awesome. So I pretty much just paved my own way. I actually started working investigations, not interviewing people, but identifying where there were gaps in investigations, like certain crimes didn't get investigated because there were no witnesses. Well, evidence was lost. Well, those crimes are typically the ones that are actually your patterns in your series. And so I would actually reach out to the victims. I would do a lot of the stuff I did in crime prevention and get surveillance video and kind of piece things together and work things up until the point it could be assigned to a detective. And I never got any pushback from that. And the analysts around me were not doing those things at the time. I think that's normal now, but given back, you know, the time frame, it was not normal. I was contacting victims and getting, you know, writing supplement reports and doing all this type of stuff and going out to the businesses, pulling surveillance, meeting the LPOs, the loss prevention officers, developing that network. And eventually that just became normal. No one ever said anything. And that was just an expectation. But not having a vision also meant that I had to work twice as hard to establish and validate the crime analysis unit. And I always called it a crime analysis unit, even though it was a unit of one for like 5 years. And I know my commanders saw what I was doing and saw, you know, the need for it and supported it. But the support wasn't a top-down, bottom-up support. So people knew I was there, but really didn't understand what I was supposed to be doing. You know, the patrol officers on the street were super appreciative of the information I was providing, but didn't have a clue what they were supposed to be doing with it. And so having my police officer personality, I was able to work through that, attend shift briefings, go to detective briefings, and push and push and push. But over the years, you know, it would have been nice to have someone say, hey, here's kind of what we want you to do. Here's kind of, you know, the parameters you need to do it in. And I think when I left Olathe, that had been established, but it took a lot longer to get there. And I hear that often when I meet with people now. I always hear the quote, they don't know what they want us to do. And then the next thing that's said from analysts, and this just happened last week at FCIAA at the conference, they don't know what we can do. So those are things are still happening across police agencies across our nation.
I think we analysts struggle. I can certainly relate to what you were saying about the analysts going out into the field and doing interviews or getting away from the desk. Because I know when I first started as an analyst, I didn't do that and I struggled with that. I was tethered to the desk. I was tethered to the data and trying to work with the data. I started in Baltimore, but I wasn't from Baltimore. I was brand new to that city. So I didn't even know what the city was like, what the people were like. And here I'm trying to analyze their crime. To be comfortable with going out and talking with different folks and really getting to know the information beyond what's in the database was a struggle for me.
I think you hit it on the head. There's reports are great. Data is great, but there's no context for it, right? Like, so you need to get out in the community. You need to go on ride-alongs. You need to see what your police officers see. It does a couple things. It does exactly what you already mentioned. It provides that context and that understanding. And visually now you can see, because honestly, like this is pre-Google Map time when I started, you know, like going out on Street View didn't exist. Mm-hmm. So I know analysts live on Street View now, and that's great. And that's awesome. But there needs to be the support for the analysts getting out in the field and not in a dangerous situation, but more just to gather context, to go look at the crime scene, to go cruise the neighborhoods and get a feel. What does it look like in the daytime versus what does it look like in the nighttime? These were things I did in crime prevention because different neighborhoods look differently from lighting to the people, to the traffic. So I think that's something that is changing too. And I know analysts that are getting out and doing more of that, but yeah, there's the context. You got to have context. And then you also have to understand that, you know, it's not always just about the numbers. There's lots of things going on in the neighborhood that the officers are not capturing in their reports. So a lot of that needs to be captured potentially by you, especially in crime trends and series that you're trying to solve.
I think another advantage that you have is you're an officer, recently former officer, talking to officers. And there's something to that. I remember I was presenting at Cincinnati Police Department on a project that the chief assigned me to. I got done, I presented a plan for the project. One of my officers that was an analyst sat me down afterwards and said, you did great, but you used the word I too much. Everybody in the room was sworn officers and they didn't like the fact that I was I this. That was a learning experience for me. I didn't even think about it at the time. I was just like, okay, this is what I came up with. This, you know, as I'm explaining what the plan is. And I talked to this person, and then I came up with the conclusion that we should go this way. That's how I was talking. And that's how I would normally talk. But to that audience, that was a big no-no.
Yeah. So that is very interesting. You know, police culture is an interesting animal. And I think there is this umbrella of police culture. And then I believe there is an agency personality and then, you know, an agency culture. And then even within that agency, there is a personality. And so know your audience is a big one. And I totally agree. I think it's great that someone sat you down and told you that. That's the first thing, because that person is trying to help you.
Sure.
And so that is awesome that that occurred. You know, I think that for new analysts coming into the field who don't have that policing perspective, agencies need to do or need to make an effort to introduce them to that, to train them into that. A lot of people leave policing because of that culture. And, you know, it's just not what they expected or just becomes too much for them. You know, little things like I versus we apparently can send a different message for analysts, but I always try to present it the way I would want to hear it. And I'm sure I made mistakes. Absolutely. I try to focus on the basics. I try to keep it, you know, I'm a very detailed person. I think a lot of analysts are, but I try to break my information down in chunks, you know, the least amount of information. What do they need to know right now? And then depending on, you know, if it's a command staff, then we get into the weeds. But yeah, you make a great point there. I did have that advantage. I didn't get the pushback that you haven't done our job. Now, I had not done the job in their city. And so I still had to go through and learn the city. You know, I lived in the city, actually, but I never really gone more than from my house to the highway and out to where I worked. So I did have a learning curve there, but it was a definite advantage. But you know, what was interesting is the policing part was great, but then the detectives, they were off site. So geographically, they were not mixed in with our police officers. They were in a different location. Okay. And they stayed to themselves. They were a hard nut to crack initially.
Yeah. Well, that's a nice segue to your badge story then, your analyst badge story. And before we get to the badge story, I just want to remind our audience that the second Thursday of every month, Mindy Yoon from LEA Podcast publishes Quick Takes, an animated series that gives you some tips on how to improve either your daily life or your process. So check those out. They're on our YouTube channel. It's the second Thursday of every month. So now to the analyst badge story, which is your career defining case or project. Dawn, what is your analyst badge story?
Well, right out of the gate, when you started a department that has never really had an analyst before, you actually, in my opinion, can only go up, right? Because everything's an improvement when you've had nothing. So I had, you know, I had some immediate successes, auto theft rings, auto burglary rings, things like that. But despite those successes, you know, you're still trying to establish. And like I mentioned, the challenge of not having a vision and really not being introduced to the department, I personally and professionally were trying to establish with my peers why I was there and what I could do for them. And it was like this marketing thing, right? You had to like go out and be like, hi. And like I said, investigations was a hard nut to crack. So I would go over there for their weekly meetings. And you know, they really wanted to keep everything close to the vest and, you know, would only share particular information. And at one of our meetings, after going through all these reports, and I had mentioned a lot of cases were not even getting read because they weren't getting assigned to detectives. So there was no way for them to know it was even happening. I'm like, hey, by the way, we've had a burglary series going on for about 3 years. Is anyone working that? And everyone's just looking at me. And I'm like, yeah, it looks like we've been targeted at commercial locations. We've had repeat hits. I've gone out and gathered all the surveillance. Here's what I can tell you. Here's all the commonalities. Here's the days of the week. Here's the times of the day. Do you think maybe we could get those cases assigned? And, you know, crickets. So I had a private meeting with the supervisor, got them assigned. So that was great. But then we started getting intel from outside agencies that other agencies were having similar incidents. And we're sharing information across our LE networks while all this is going on. And eventually, although they were working the cases, they weren't rising to the top. They, you know, there was no evidence. There was nothing that, you know, could really pinpoint who was doing this at the time. Until the local Department of Motor Vehicles got hit, which is a county building. So one of the local detectives from Johnson County Sheriff's Office, he decides he's going to send this information out. It was a big loss. It was a safe that was hit and it was over $30,000 in one swoop. Wow. There were a lot of issues with this because the money shouldn't even have been there that night, but none of that matters. They got hit and they have all been tasked with solving this case. So I reach out to Lucky Smith, who was a detective at the time. He's since retired. And I said, hey, I believe I have some cases that are related to your case. And here's why I think that. And Lucky not only listened, he and I met and I laid out all my stuff. And I said, I truly believe this is related and here's why. And he said, I think you're right. Now let's figure out what we can do about it. So with his support, I initiated a request to start a task force. obviously I couldn't have done this on my own. So I had to have the support of him. I had to have the support of my sergeant, who was like, okay, let's do this. So immediately detectives from all the Johnson County area agencies came together. They developed a plan. This guy was hitting in the middle of the night when most detectives are sleeping unless they've been called out. So they had this whole, you know, elaborate call out plan. And eventually one night, a very astute police officer in Shawnee, Kansas, pulled over a van he thought was suspicious and developed a really great lead, which led to the development of our suspect. And GPS was able to be placed on the suspect's vehicle. And they tracked him. And every time he would start moving in the middle of the night, the team would go up live on him. Mm-hmm. And then one night, it all blew up. They actually, this probably sounds horrible to people who don't know police do this, but they actually let him hit some places, you know, arresting someone for an attempt versus arresting for a successful burglary are very different, but
sure.
You know, they allowed a couple places to get hit and did their takedown. And so this all culminates because I had fought very, very hard to get this moving and really have a voice in this. In the middle of the night, I was awakened by a text message from Detective Lucky Smith. And all it was a photograph of a bag, a black duffel bag with cash. And the thing said, "We got him." So you talk about I versus we. That was a big deal to me.
Yeah.
And so that was a notch, right? Like, hey, you know, she was right. She felt this way. Now, here's how this all turned out. This guy, his name was Brian Coos, and Brian Coos, he's done his time. It's all been prosecuted, but it came to light. I mean, I had a list of over 35 burglaries just in my city over like 4-year period. That's just my city. Mm-hmm. So he ended up proffering and sat down with the police and admitted to everything that we had on him. Wow. Every agency went in one by one and talked to him. He's very forthcoming, actually a really nice guy. But some of the key things in there that I didn't get listened to was the argument of whether it was two people or three people, it has to be a group versus one. And I said, no, it's one guy. It's one guy. And the reason I know it's one guy is because he hasn't been caught yet. And if there were two people, they would have talked already. Like someone would have talked to someone. And it was really funny because what got him busted was the DMV. He actually took a TV also for his girlfriend. So that's what actually got him busted. And all the other ones, he had only taken cash. So because there was another person and obviously a woman involved, you know, they always say women get you in trouble, he got busted. But there were a lot of like learning things that came out of that. And I learned to advocate better. I learned to understand the process. I learned better communication skills with my sergeant that I had at the time. So, you know, there was a lot of learning. That guy went away. You know, he went away for about 4 years. He took a plea for straight time. He didn't get charged with everything because he proffered. And he did straight time and came out.
Now, do you have an idea of just the total value of what was stolen?
Well, it was always cash. And he'd always hit like loan places, like title loan places. So places that had a lot of cash. You know, I don't recall at this point. That was back in like 2009. Okay. So my brain has been filled with all kinds of stories since then. But I mean, the one hit was over 30,000 just that one time.
That's interesting. Did he just get lucky that particular night there was $30,000 cash in that safe? Because you mentioned that it wasn't supposed to be there.
I don't know. I think he did just get lucky. I think someone failed to do their job and that place had actually just opened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was pretty extravagant though. This guy would cut the alarm line, wait to see if the police responded. When the police didn't respond, he would then go in an adjacent office, cut a hole in the wall and crawl through. He would target the safe. And that was one of the things Lucky and I argued about because he said, that safe is massive. There is no way one guy did that. I said, I'm telling you, there's a floor jack involved and it's one guy. And sure enough, there was. So we have a lot of fun still talking about it.
So was that the MO then that you were able to link all these cases together with certain aspects of going through walls and the timing and the targets and whatnot?
That's one of those all things together, looking at the MO and all the details that were involved. But one of the other key features was that when he was caught on surveillance, it was usually only his hand, and he wore a particular style of glove. And so I was like, this is the same glove, you know? I mean, so we can make all kinds of jokes about gloves and criminals, but
yeah. You became a glove expert, right?
Whatever it took.
All right. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I do want to talk about your transition to GeoTime. And I also want to talk about the IACA, and we'll get into your personal interest as a dancer.
Sounds good.
You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is Steve Belts, and I got a pet peeve I want to share with you folks. You know, we all have the cell phone driving issue, but I kind of take it down more to the local level here. It's not dangerous, but extremely annoying. I'm having to make my way through airports now again, and you get that person in front of you that's either reading something off their cell phone or talking to somebody on their cell phone, and you're trying to get to your gate, and you don't realize that people are backing up behind them, just like as if they were driving a car. Get off your cell phones and or pull over to the curb with your cell phone in the airport and get it out of the way. So appreciate it. Thanks.
Hi, this is Carolyn Cassidy, and I'd like to give some information to you. We've all watched shows on TV where someone comes home and there's been a break-in. Their house is disrupted and possibly items have been stolen. Someone gets on the phone and calls 911. Help, please come. I've been robbed. Okay, let's clarify this. You have not been robbed. You have been burgled. A robbery is a person-to-person crime. A burglary is a property crime. If you are not home when someone comes in and takes something from you, you have been burgled. There has not been a robbery. Hashtag, you were burgled, not robbed.
Welcome back. Dawn, I want to talk about your transition then to GeoTime. So you make another pretty big leap from civilian analyst. Now you're going to the private sector, working for GeoTime. So let's talk about that transition.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out how to frame this. And I think it goes like this. I always said, you know, people around me, police officers, they always talk about when they're going to retire. I don't know if that was just in the agency I was in, but like there are people that have it down to the day, the hour, the second.
Yeah, counter.
And I would always fall into these conversations somehow. And they'd ask me like, when are you going to retire? And my answer was always the same. And I said, you know, I'm no longer doing what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And, or sometimes I'd say when it was no longer fun, no longer a challenge. And I think I'd settle on when it was no longer a challenge. And so I started feeling that way. And I started trying to figure out, why do I feel that way? Is it the culture? Is it just the type of stuff we're dealing with on a daily basis? You know, just the victimization. What is it? But eventually I landed into, the agency itself was kind of stagnant. There wasn't a vision for crime analysis where I was at. And there really wasn't a discussion on a vision. And for me, professionally, I have to always be moving forward towards something. I don't always have to be moving up a chain or towards supervision. But I had to always have movement and change. And, you know, whether that was, you know, digging into something new, adding a new software, learning something new about technology, teaching, whatever it might be, I need that challenge that feeds my soul. So I started seeking outside opportunities. I started looking at other jobs that were in the same retirement system that I was already in, because ultimately, yeah, you don't want to lose that type of stuff. That's the adulting stuff we have to think about. Yeah. You know, I put in for a couple things and they were a little outside of the box thinking for me, but my skills were applicable to that. And I was like, well, this looks really neat and this has a great opportunity. And I just never got there. Private sector was nothing I'd ever considered. I just was like, that's the dark side. No one goes to the dark side, you know, but recently that's not true. A lot of people I respect have gone to the dark side. And so I started kind of working with that. And so eventually the opportunity came up and GeoTime had put out a listing on, you know, law enforcement liaison, and it piqued my interest. And I reached out to who's now my director, Adil Kamisa. And the big reason why I reached out to them is because when I was involved in the IACA, And when I attended conferences, one of the things that I did do is I was a vendor chair for one of the conferences multiple times in a row. And, you know, Uncharted Software, everyone knows them as GeoTime. They had been vendors. I had met them. I had talked with them. I had great rapport with them. And they were super cool people. And I loved their product. And so that right there was like, okay, I think I'm going to reach out and see what's going on. So after I did that, you know, eventually, you know, we're in discussion and all of that. And eventually all of it comes to fruition. And I was super impressed by the people. I was super impressed by their approach. And eventually I just decided to make the leap, you know, and when I left Olathe, I would say people were probably surprised because there had really been no clue that I was getting ready to make that leap. But it was just one of those things. It was timing and being able to do something new. And technology is a field that, you know, I don't know if a lot of crime analysts consider themselves to be technology or technologically savvy, but I feel like you should be. And it's something that you should always stay up on because it's ever changing and it'll also improve what you do and make you more efficient and effective. And so I'd like to think, you know, I brought all that to the table, but it piqued my curiosity.
Yeah. So how many analysts does Olathe have?
Olathe never grew past two analysts.
Okay.
And it took 5 years to get the second position, which I thought, okay, that seemed okay to me at the time because we went through, again, this is in the 2000s. We actually went through like this sort of mini recession and, you know, agencies were cutting analysts and we were seeing that. And I was actually worried that I would be cut, but instead of that happening, they actually added someone. So that was validation for what I had been doing for the agency and what crime analysis had done for them, that they saw the value in it. But, you know, now we're at 10 years and we still don't have another analyst and we're being asked to do more. We're getting tasked with more stats. We're getting tasked with more technology and to manage that. And we're getting called out more because crime is rising. And so there was a lot going on that led to my decision. But really, it was the lack of movement and lack of vision.
So then the transition from the public sector to the private sector, what was those growing pains like?
You know, it was kind of shocking, but in a positive way. So I had reached out and, you know, I've developed a lot of friends through the IACA, and one of my friends, Allison Sullivan, had made the leap, and I had spoken to her about her thoughts. And you know, she's with Cobwebs now, but she has a really great resume and as a former analyst with multiple agencies. So I talked to her. I had even reached out to one of the vendors, Ashley Sackrider with Leads Online, and was chatting with her, you know, just trying to kind of wrap my mind around kind of what this might look like. But I honestly could not have ever prepared myself for the most refreshing feeling that I've ever had in the last 20 years. I mean, someone saw me from my old agency about, I don't know, a couple of weeks after I left, and maybe even a little bit more because I was actually with GeoTime by then. And one person said to me, "You just look so happy and relaxed." I said, "You too can do this," like in a commercial.
Yes.
But, you know, the cool part is they hired me as an expert in the field that I was leaving. And the minute I showed up, they treated me like an expert for which they hired me to be. And they value that. And that comes through in everything that we do. And there is a voice. I have a voice. It's valued. And I can make suggestions. We talk through it. And the craziest part about this is I see the results. Like, things change very quickly. So all of that is super refreshing for me. And, you know, it was a much needed change.
Yeah, I think it is interesting. I can relate when I moved from law enforcement to Vanderbilt. It was so refreshing to just have a team environment and to have a supervisor that understood the data even, and to talk through roadblocks and workarounds. I had felt so alone or been on my own my whole career up to that point. And so that was so refreshing getting into that environment. So I can relate to what you're saying.
For me, it's more about the thinking involved. So this might sound a little off the wall, but analysts don't necessarily think like cops. Even analysts that used to be cops, we think about things a little differently. We visualize, I'm a visual thinker. I don't know if that's actually a thing, but when you say something to me, I can like actually visualize how that interconnects. And sometimes I even look up, which throws people off. I have to explain what I'm doing, but I'm like, hold on, I'm trying to figure out this visually. And so having a different line of thinking can often be difficult for analysts in an environment that doesn't make, you know, isn't conducive to that, or an agency personality that isn't conducive to that or doesn't value that. I actually think the opposite. I don't believe all like-minded people should come together. I believe people that have all different views are what can affect change on something. And I will tell you, in a lot of our investigation, I finally told my team and requested, I guess is a better word. I told them, but I guess in their minds, I requested it. That please, when we do these like round tables, can I go last? I just want to go last because one, I don't want to step on anyone's toes. Because, you know, that is happens sometimes. You're like, oh, why'd you tell everyone everything? Now so-and-so can't say it. Okay, mm-hmm. Whatever.
Yeah.
So I would go last and I would try to wrap what everyone else said into the package for the big picture, that 360 degree view. But I can clearly remember being in a room when we were in the middle of a homicide and we were discussing ways to solve this crime. And everyone was talking about, well, we have this. And, you know, not that they weren't being value added to the conversation, they were, but it got to me. And I said, in front of the DA, in front of our chief, in front of the sheriff, people like everyone outside agency, I said, we're all talking about what we have. Well, none of that is leading us to the answer. So let's figure out what we don't have and how we get there. And we shifted it. Like, I was like, and here's what I mean by that. I could have been shut down. They could have looked at me like, what are you talking about? But what actually happened is there was one commander in the room that I would tell you, he's probably one of the hardest people to work for. Very structured, you know, democracy is really not his thing. And, you know, everyone knows that. He kind of looked at me and I thought, oh, this is where I get let go. This is the moment that he's like, you can leave the room now. And he said, I absolutely agree with you. Whatever she says we're going to do is what we're going to do. So Dawn, what's our plan going to be? And I was like, Oh, holy crap. You know, so that is what happens where I'm at now. We talk about it and I don't feel that sense of angst when I want to have an opposing opinion or have an opposing idea or say, hey, have we thought about this? Or here's what I think might work. That is not the environment I'm in now. And that just creates an entire relaxation. You know, you can just kind of relax and breathe. But it's also conducive to positive things and growth.
Yeah.
And technology is one of those ever-changing areas where you have to be flexible. And so that's something that's really great about our team.
So I was curious how you would describe your position. Are you an analyst? Are you a salesperson? Are you doing marketing?
Well, in short, my coworker, Mike Berndle, would say we make folks rock stars. But that doesn't really answer your question. We do a lot as law enforcement liaisons. In the end, the idea is that we want you to use our products to be more efficient and effective, solve crime, prevent crime, predict crime, catch people doing criminal activity. That's really the end goal. But we do it in a way that is, I think, very non-traditional for other, if you want to call us vendors, that assist crime analysis. We do it through education. So technology is a field that is ever changing, but it's also a field that agencies are finding themselves having to learn a lot more about in order to solve crime. You know, understanding the internet, understanding how to find things on the internet, understanding for our area, geolocation data, anything with a date, time, longitude, latitude, and then really trying to figure out how to use all that and harness all that in a way that we can both understand it, visually make it pleasing, and then share it with others, the goal of prosecuting the offender. So we do a lot of educating, not just on how to use our product, but what the data is itself that they're using, what it means. And we have a lot of experts that help with that. We do professional development. This is something that people might not know, but you know, a lot of people have the training to use software and have the training to create maps and explain cases, but they don't have the professional development to go to court. And so we're doing a lot of like testimony. How do I testify on this type of stuff? What are suggestions? We actually just did a webinar where Daryl Valencius, one of our experts from retired NYPD, did all the different things, you know, defense attorneys can potentially ask you. So, you know, we're trying to professionally develop our users as well and coach them, give them ideas. And then ultimately, yeah, I mean, we want you to take our software. We want you to use it and we want you to be rock stars. And that might mean different things for different people. It might mean finding the key information that helps solve your crime. It might mean being able to visualize really complex data in a way that helps you both find the answer, but explain it to the jury. So really that can mean something different every day. It just depends on who's asking and what agency might be involved. But ultimately, if you see us at a conference, please don't be afraid.
You won't bite.
We won't bite. Some people are more outgoing than others, but we want to talk to you. We also want to be a resource for you. I would be completely transparent in saying that anyone that's coming to a crime analyst conference, IACA, please network with them. Any vendor, go learn what they can help you out with. Get their names, get their cards. I mean, you don't ever have to buy anything, but when you need help, you need those contacts. So you need that network. And that's actually one of the things that I did with GeoTime. We were in the middle of a homicide investigation and we had no software to analyze the critical evidence related to the cell phone data, related to the Google data, Uber data. We had nothing. And I had been asking for something and it just hadn't risen to the level of importance until in the middle of the investigation. Do not be that person. But I knew when I needed help, I reached out to Adil Kamisa and I said, hey, I know I met you. I know we've talked. I know I've said I'm going to do this before this moment, but I need help. And they jumped on it.
Nice.
And it helped. That case has not gone to court. So I really can't talk about it.
Okay. I gotcha. Well, very good. So I do want to move on though. I do want to get some time in for the IACA. And you were secretary from 2008 to 2015, which is 7 years. This is a pretty long time. So my first question for you is, when you look back now, what are you most proud of that you accomplished during those 7 years?
Well, let me just quote Charles Dickens. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. No, that's a joke, Jason.
I know.
You know, I loved being a part of the IACA, and I actually started, I was introduced to the IACA by, you know, Susan Wernicke at the time, but through Mark Han and through Jamie May with Overland Park, and Jamie was really involved in the IACA, and I saw an extreme value, and you mentioned I was the Mark Han president. I was actually on like the founding group that established that. I remember being in the room when we all decided we needed an association. So the IACA was a natural progression for me. I remember rooming with people to be able to get to the conference in 2000, I think it was 2000, in Denver. So I remember trying to do whatever I could to try and get there and really soak in the information and go to the sessions and try to better myself, both personally and professionally for my agency when I was just getting started. And all of that was just like this trajectory into volunteering. And, you know, it is 100% a volunteer association. So everyone is doing everything on their free time, which is really a joke because you don't have any of that. And so, you know, that moved into being the vendor rep for a couple conferences, which I mentioned. And then eventually that moved into deciding I wanted to put more time in. You know, I wouldn't trade my experience with the IACA for anything. I took away a lot and I met a lot of really great people. And, you know, I've listened to your other podcasts. I've heard people talk about the IACA and I've heard the term like it becomes a family. And that's very, very true. It becomes a family. You know, sometimes it's really hard to separate the personal from the professional. But, you know, I met my board that I had was awesome. And the experiences for the most part were awesome. And I got to meet tons of people that all had the same goal, which was to professionalize crime analysis, the field of crime analysis. And so during my time frame, that was really the focus of our board. And we put in a lot of effort to try to further crime analysis, professionalize it, make it value added to every police agency. And so looking back where we were and looking where we are now, I feel like I and that board, we had a really big effect on that. We played a bit really big role in that. So some of the things that have kind of come to fruition now that we established were publications committee has kind of taken off. We were doing that as well, but we've seen now that even go further. The bylaws committee, you know, we're actually seeing some of those changes that our board had identified and suggested with the assistance of the association members actually get put into play, which was awesome to see. So great job on that. The mentoring committee, you know, that's something that was established under Erica Jackson. And that was really something that she tried to get off the ground and moving. And we had it going there before we left the board. So that's really taken off. And, you know, Sally Rawlings and that team are heading that up now, which is great. Couldn't think of a better person. And then it's changed names a couple of times, but the Educational and Student Affairs Committee, Jason Painich, that was actually started under me. It struggled. We were trying to figure out a direction. And so it's awesome to see that's taking off. So, you know, a lot of things are moving forward, which is great to see.
And that's colleges and universities, I think, what the name of it is now. And why I'm thinking about it, Jason is stepping down. So if people in the audience are interested in volunteering for that committee, they are looking for a chair. So that's an opportunity to work with young adults trying to get into the field of analysis.
Which is so interesting because I actually have taught for Baker University for the last 6 years. So maybe that's something I should look at.
There you go. You pass on your own torch, right?
Well, that's weird. Yeah. You know, on all that free time we all have.
Yes. You were secretary during this time in this board. And it's interesting you use the term this board because it was at this time where the board was a cohort. You got elected all at the same time. All positions were elected at one time. So you felt like a group, a cohort, and now it's stagnant. So you have some of the positions elected some years, others not. And it doesn't seem like it has the same group feeling as people are always coming and going. It seems like every other year. But this is also a time where, as I mentioned on the show, for lack of a better term, call it the Civil War, because this is a time when it's tumultuous and there are a lot of things going on in the association that gave a black eye to the association for those looking on the outside. And there was some infighting and some things that, you know, you talked about bylaws and talked about ethics, all of that gets reevaluated by some of the things that happened during this time. So I wanted to give you an opportunity just to talk about this. And you mentioned it's the best of times and the worst of times. So I did do my best to talk about what's positive first, but you could talk about the worst of times.
Yeah. If you're new, you have no idea what we're talking about. And that's fantastic. And quite honestly, I would love for it to stay that way. And a lot of people, and even you, Jason, asked like, hey, what really happened? What really went down? And I think ultimately there's no reason to put out all of that stuff. You know, the board is made up of a group of people that come from different backgrounds and have different things going on in their lives. And when you get a bunch of people together, you're going to have different personalities. And it can also create conflict. And like I previously mentioned, I don't think it's bad to necessarily have conflict and have, you know, differing opinions. I think managing that is the key. And so the board always tried to do what was right by the association. And we always tried to go by the bylaws. And at that time, things were sort of unclear. We were having growing pains. We were looking at the bylaws anyway. We were trying to figure out, do the bylaws actually help us given where we're at now in our association? Do they need to be adjusted? And so a lot of that really kind of forced that discussion to happen sooner. And so I think good things have actually come of that. But ultimately, we just tried to do what was right. And, you know, I will tell you from the inside looking out versus the outside looking in, it may have a different view. But when you have the board who has to remain above board and whose message represents the association, you know, that message needs to do exactly that. There isn't the freedom to allow personal thoughts or ideas or things like that. We're a board, we vote, and we vote on those messages. And that hasn't changed. That's still the same in your board today. And not everyone always agrees. you know, but the board has to come to a consensus. And that's Robert's Rules of Order. I mean, that's what we had to follow at the time. So I think overall, the takeaway really is that, you know, I always say this, but there's three versions of the truth. There's yours, mine, and the truth. And that goes for this as well. You know, I just hope some people have moved on, and it's been a long time. And it's great to see that previous boards, because now we've gone through a couple cycles since that time, have really been able to take what was, as you mentioned, you know, a very difficult time and change that and make it better for the association. Change comes from sometimes rough times. And so I think we've actually all seen that come to fruition. And that's really all we ever wanted for the IACA, which was, you know, continue moving it forward, continue doing great things. And, you know, one thing I had mentioned to you is like, you know, one of the bigger things that our board actually did with the input of a lot of the members and a lot of really great people is, you know, the training. And because having all the training online pre-pandemic, I'm sure the IA was already ahead of the time. So some of this forward thinking, which I think all the volunteers come together and all the volunteers, people that want to be active, can create positive effects to push the profession of crime analysis forward. And that was our goal.
Yeah. And I always respect everybody's wishes. When we do the prep calls for these shows, I tell people, look, if there's a topic you don't want to talk about, we won't talk about that. So I am not very pushy, although I'm very curious. I am very, very curious because I think there's a great story to tell in all of this. But a concern that I do have is that because everybody wants to bury it and doesn't want to talk about it, and there were certain things never really resolved, you have certain things that happened that are questionable, and certain people did things that are questionable. Because nobody knows about what certain people did, they are free to either still be a part of the association or can still be part of the association in the future, which does worry me in a way. I understand that making it all known to all the association may not necessarily do anybody any good, so to speak. I do find that a concern, that if there was certain behavior that was done during this time, the association as a whole found out, they'd be like, I don't know if I necessarily want that person representing our association.
Yeah. And, you know, I understand your point of view. And what I guess all I would say to that is that there are processes in place. If you would like to get that information, you know, if you're that person that's curious, you know, there probably are processes in place, but, you know, it is what it is in terms of what happened when I was on the board. You know, the processes, we went through everything we were supposed to go through. And the way it turned out is the way it turned out. And we tried to use all the processes correctly. And, you know, I'm sure there could be other people that feel the same as you or feel completely opposite.
Yes.
You know, so, and you just have to figure out, if you want to know the truth, whatever version it might be, you just have to ask, you know, ask the people. But in terms of my opinion, what is done is done. And, you know, in the end, Carolyn Cassidy, Erica Jackson, Tony Berger, and Eric Driftmeyer and I just wanted what was best for the association. And now seeing what has been done in terms of how the association has grown, how Mary and Annie Mitchell, Albert Mesa, Mike Winslow, Sally Allison, Samantha Gwen, and Mary Craig, those were all the people that were truly involved, you know, at really cool times and still are. We need all those people. And we need a place for all those people to come together that lacks drama and lacks, you know, a negative environment. So, you know, we do need to understand what processes are in place. And if you really want your questions answered, I'm sure you can put in a request. Or you can just meet one of us at the bar one night and have a glass of wine with me. But, you know, I mean, it's the goal is not to churn up anything that happened. The goal is just to move forward and really kind of just look at the positives that have come out of it for the association. And quite honestly, I think for a lot of us personally and professionally, because some of us were pushed out of our comfort zone. We had to learn new things. We had to handle things. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we were all just volunteers, you know? So I hope everyone that was involved in that has been able to move on. And I hope that the positives that have come out have overshadowed the negatives that might be hanging on.
Yeah, it was all fun and games until it wasn't, it seems. So. But hey, anyway, thank you for that. I do want to move on to your advice to the audience. One question I like to ask is return on investment. Is there something that you would advise the audience to study now because in 5 years from now, it's going to be important?
Your retirement portfolio? is that an actual? No.
That is important. That is important. I was hoping for something law enforcement analyst related, but that is important. That is a key. Check on your retirement portfolio.
Yeah. 5 years from now, I think just have the ability to see 5 years from now, to sure. plan 5 years from now, to set your goal. You know, I have to say a lot of the reason why I left Olathe is because when I got to the 10 year, I wasn't even at my 5 year goal.
Yeah.
You know, and have your resume always up to date because you just never know what opportunity could knock on your door or where you could go look for it. So be ready, always be open, have a plan, and never, ever sell yourself short. You know, that's something I hear from people all the time. Like, well, I'm not a decision maker. And, you know, when you work these conferences and your whole job is to talk to people and you're selling something or they view you as that, which I just explained, we're not just that. But, mm-hmm. you know, you have that moment. A lot of them are dismissive and say, well, I'm not a decision maker. And you know what? Maybe you're not in command staff. Maybe you're not a supervisor. Maybe you've only been there 1 year, 6 months, 3 months. But you are an influencer.
Yes.
And you should never forget that. When people want to know what technology they might need, when people want to know what is coming up, always have those answers. Be the influencer. And don't wait for people to ask.
Very good. I was going to ask you other things about advice, but I think that's just a fantastic answer all the way around. So I'm going to move on to my last question, and that's the personal interest, because I'm always curious of what people do, I guess, on other times. I won't call it their free time, because you're right, we don't have free time. But when they do seem to have choices, what do they like to do with their time? And for you, you're a dancer. When I think about you and I think about you being a dancer, I can't remember what IACA conference it was, but you had everybody dancing to Thriller, Michael Jackson's Thriller, and with the actual moves. And yeah. Do you remember that? I can't remember what year is that. That's probably like a 2013-ish time frame. I can't remember even where it was. I just remember the dance floor and everybody doing the Thriller dance.
Yeah. So I really wish this was a video because you could see me smiling from ear to ear. But those times, you know, at the IACA networking or even just out with the IACA at the conferences, the times we dance, man, those are the best times. And music is amazing. Music just gets me moving. And I love to dance. And I actually danced when I was younger. I've actually raised kids who are dancers. My son's into hip hop. My daughter is in classical ballet, but also does hip hop and other things. So dancing is in our DNA. And I love to share it. And I'm a silly dancer. Like, I just want to have fun. I just want people to get up. I don't care if you think you can dance or not. Like, that's kind of my thing. And, you know, Albert Mesa jokes around and calls me Tiny Dancer. And I can't remember which conference that was, but the reason I can't remember has nothing to do with the open bar. It has to do with there have been so many great times, Jason, dancing and carrying on and just being with people that I like and that I've developed friendships with and that just enjoy having fun. And so dancing is great. That's when we let go and that's when we're loose and we just have a good time. But yeah, I'm into dancing in my free time. And, you know, the pandemic has really squashed that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I still dance in my kitchen. There, I really, my kitchen's for dancing. I actually have a sign that says that.
Nice.
Yeah. But I miss that. I miss that time with all the IACA folks having a good time. And that's why, you know, now that we're slowly opening up and conferences are happening again, I'm just loving running into people and seeing them again and being able to talk to them again and have those fun times.
Very good.
And in terms of, like, you know, things I like to do on this, you know, in my free time, I travel a lot for my position. So what I like to do is maximize that and tack on personal days in the locations I go to. For me, a lot of that is like, you know, I just saw you and I was going to the beach. A lot of that is like going to the beach, doing things with my kids. Now that they're older, I can bring them with me. They can travel with me without having to have my husband there, and they can go do their own thing. So I'm into experiences now, I think way more than I was before.
Yeah, that's one thing. We traveled to Chile together for the IACA. Yes. And that was one thing that in hindsight, I wish I would have took a day and just gone to explore, because I just don't know the next time I'm going to get down there to Chile. So
yeah, it was
a wonderful time.
It was. And, you know, that's just another awesome positive thing about becoming involved in the IACA is the opportunities that, you know, can happen to take you to other places, meet other people that do the same thing in other countries, and people, you know, outside looking in. And I'm sure if people saw our social media posts, it probably looked like we were playing the whole time. But if they knew how hard we worked, how scheduled it was, like there was so much packed in and trying to be positive and impress the IACA and bring what our association can take to other countries. It's a lot of work. And so all those volunteers, they're actually working for you.
Yeah, it was a lot of work. It was exciting. It's probably the closest that I'll ever feel to being a
dignitary.
Dignitary. There you go. Thank you. That's the closest I'll probably be, because that's what it felt like.
We were very important people there. It was awesome.
Yes. Very good. All right. Well, our last segment to the show is Words to the World. And this is where I give you the last word and you can promote any idea that you wish. Dawn, what are your words to the world?
So I have this saying, it goes like this. You will always get 100% of what you don't ask for. And what I mean by that is if you never know unless you ask. So be bold, be your own advocate, and always be true to yourself, and you can't go wrong.
Very good. Well, I leave everyone with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later, but I do appreciate you being on the show, Dawn. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcasts.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Elder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.